Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Hello and thanks for joining us for Into the Killing. If you know of any cold cases that were eventually solved that you want us to cover on Into the Killing, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. You can also suggest cases for our two YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. For this episode, we're going back to August 1986. On August 4th, 1986, after three seasons, the team owners in the United States Football League, also known as the USFL, voted to suspend the fourth season. The idea behind the league was to play football in the spring and summer when there was no NFL or college games. It was also supposed to be more fun than the NFL. For example, the players were allowed to have more elaborate celebrations. In the opening season, there were 12 teams. The football was considered good, and in its first 3 years of operation, the league had signed three consecutive Heisman Trophy winners. Just before the league's second season started in 1984, Donald Trump bought the team, the New Jersey Generals, for $10 million. 3 years earlier, Trump had fronted a group that tried to buy the NFL's Baltimore Colts, but their offer of $50 million was rejected. Shortly after buying the team, Trump started pushing other owners to change the schedule from the spring and summer to the winter and autumn to compete with the NFL. He said, quote, "If God wanted football in the spring, he would have never created baseball," unquote. Trump went as far as to disguise his voice and call reporters, claiming he was a publicist named John Barron who worked for Trump. While pretending to be Barron, he badmouthed the commissioner of the USFL. In March 1984, Trump secretly met with NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle. Rozelle claimed that Trump, who set up the meeting, begged for an NFL team. He said he would blow up the USFL if it meant getting an NFL team. Rozelle told him he would never own an NFL team as long as he and any of his heirs were involved with the NFL. In May 1984, there was a USFL owners meeting. Trump told the owners that if they moved the season to autumn and winter, the USFL and the NFL could merge. To do this, they were going to sue the NFL for having a monopoly of pro football. After they were victorious, the NFL would have no choice but to merge the two leagues. So a majority of the owners voted to move the schedule to the autumn and winter starting in 1986. In 1985, the New Jersey Generals signed quarterback Doug Flutie. Flutie had won the Heisman Trophy. The Generals signed him to a mind-boggling $7 million for 5 years. This made Flutie the highest-paid pro football player and highest-paid rookie in any sport. Trump then demanded that other USFL teams help pay Flutie's contract. He argued that the salary drew Flutie to the USFL instead of the NFL. People would tune in to see him on TV and pay money to see him play live. But no one paid Trump a cent. A hearing for the lawsuit brought on by Trump was held in the summer of 1986. Trump was the USFL's star witness. The NFL's lawyers produced documents showing that Trump was suing the NFL in the hopes that the NFL and USFL would merge and he would get an NFL team. Trump denied this was true, but provided no evidence. The jury found that the NFL had a de facto monopoly on professional football, which harmed the USFL. However, they believed that most of the USFL's problems were caused by mismanagement and had nothing to do with the NFL. The USFL was only awarded $3. Shortly after the season was suspended, on August 4th, 1986, the USFL folded. It was revived in 2022 for two seasons, then emerged with the XFL and is now known as the United Football League. In August 1988, 44-year-old Patrick Sherrill was a postal worker who lived in Edmond, Oklahoma. Many people described him as a quiet loner. On August 19, 1986, Sherrill was reprimanded by two managers for his poor performance. The next day, Sherrill brought three .45 caliber handguns to the post office where he worked. He shot one of the managers who reprimanded him the day before. Cheryl went on to murder 13 other co-workers and injured 6 others. After about 15 minutes, he turned the gun on himself. The other manager who reprimanded him had slept in that day and wasn't there when the shooting started. The Edmonton Post Office shooting is the deadliest workplace shooting in U.S. history. It was one of several mass shootings at a postal facility that inspired the phrase, going postal. On August 21, 1986, a rare but devastating natural hazard happened in northwest Cameroon. Cameroon is a country in Central Africa. Lake Nyos is a freshwater lake in Cameroon. There was a limnic eruption, also known as the lake overturn. The lake had high levels of carbon dioxide and essentially burped up a cloud of carbon dioxide. The cloud settled on the ground. 1,746 people and 3,500 livestock were asphyxiated to death. It was only the second limnic eruption in recorded history. The first one happened 2 years earlier in a different lake in Cameroon. 37 people were killed. There have been no other limnic eruptions since. But experts are worried that a bigger lake on the borders of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo could have a limnic eruption. If there is a limnic eruption, millions of lives could be in danger. Precautions are being taken at all three lakes to prevent another limnic eruption. On August 13, 1986, the number one song was Papa Don't Preach by Madonna. The number one movie was the sci-fi classic Aliens. Michael Morton and Christine Kirkpatrick met at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas in 1976. The following year, Michael dropped out and planned to attend the University of Texas in Austin. Christine dropped out as well to make the 220-mile move with him. However, they couldn't transfer many of their credits, so they decided to stop pursuing a university degree. Michael got a job stocking shelves at a grocery store at night. In 1979, Michael and Christine were married. Their friend said that when they fought, they were very blunt and honest, but no one got the sense that they were unhappy. It was just the way they communicated with each other. In 1981, Christine was pregnant. But then, at 4.5 months, she miscarried. 2 years later, she was pregnant again. There were no complications with the pregnancy. Christine gave birth to a son, Eric, in the summer of 1983. Eric needed emergency surgery the day he was born. There was an abnormality in his esophagus. He was in the neonatal unit for 3 weeks, during which he was examined. It turned out he had a congenital heart defect, and his heart was getting the proper amount of oxygen. Eric required open heart surgery, but he was too small to receive the surgery. He had to wait until he was 3, or weighed 30 pounds. Both Michael and Christine were worried about their son. They both work full-time as well. Christine was the manager at an insurance company, and Michael had worked his way up to department manager of the supermarket. The stress was difficult on the couple, and they bickered more often. Michael complained to his friends about his sex life, and he made cracks about Christine's weight. In 1985, the family moved into a house they purchased in a half-built subdivision in Austin. The neighbors found Christine warm and friendly, while they thought Michael was cold and remote. In June 1986, Eric had open-heart surgery. The surgery was a success. Six and a half weeks later, on August 12, 1986, Michael, Christine, and Eric went out to a restaurant for dinner. It was Michael's 32nd birthday. Afterward, the family went home. Michael wanted to have sex that night, but Christine fell asleep. The next morning, Michael wrote a note for his wife as he got ready for work. The note read, quote, "Chris, I know you didn't mean to, but you made me feel really unwanted last night. After a good meal, we came home. You binge on the rest of the cookies. Then, with your nightgown around your waist, and while I was rubbing your hands and arms, you farted and fell asleep. I'm not mad or expecting a big production. I just wanted you to know how I feel without us getting into another fight about sex. Just think how you might have felt if you were left hanging on your birthday." Unquote. Michael left the note on the bedroom mirror. Around 5:30 a.m., Michael left for work and punched in at 6:05 a.m. At about 1 o'clock that afternoon, a neighbor of the Mordens noticed something unusual. 3-year-old Eric was wandering around the yard by himself. The neighbor went into the family's home. In the bed, she found the dead body of 31-year-old Christine Morden. She had been bludgeoned to death. The murder weapon, which was in the house, was a wooden object. Christine had been struck 8 times in the head. After she was dead, a comforter was put over her face, and then a suitcase and a wicker basket were tossed on top of her body. She had been bludgeoned to death.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at COTA.com.
The Williamson County Sheriff's Department was handling the investigation. Sheriff Jim Beltwell immediately suspected that Michael had killed his wife. Beltwell was a controversial sheriff. 3 years earlier, in June 1983, Henry Lee Lucas was arrested for firearm violations. Lucas had murdered his mother, 71-year-old Viola Lucas, in January 1960. He had served 10 years in prison for the murder. After being arrested for the firearms violation, Lucas confessed to murdering 2 women, 8-year-old Kate Rich and 15-year-old Becky Powell. Lucas had been a handyman for Rich, and Powell had been his common-law wife. He led the police to the remains of the 2 women. Later, Lucas said that over 10 years, he killed over 100 women in 17 states. Beltwell was notified that Lucas had confessed to a murder in Williamson County. Beltwell questioned Lucas and showed him a photo of an unidentified murder victim known as Orange Socks. When the woman's body was found on Halloween 1979, she only had orange socks on. At the time, her identity was unknown. Lucas didn't know her name, but he admitted he killed her. There's evidence that Beltwell fed Lucas information about the murder. Lucas's so-called confession had to be recorded 4 times before it matched the evidence. There was a 5th-written confession that was different from the other 4 confessions. Based on the confessions, Lucas was charged with the murder of Orange Socks. Lucas went on to confess to over 600 murders. Beltwell often accompanied Lucas to different jurisdictions and usually sat in on interviews. Texas Ranger Phil Ryan said, quote, "You never saw Henry without Beltwell," unquote. In April 1984, Henry Lee Lucas went to trial for the murder of Orange Socks. The only evidence against him were the 5 confessions, which weren't accurate. The defense had evidence that Lucas was over 1,000 miles away in Jacksonville, Florida, at the time of the murder. He was working as a roofer. He was at work the day of and the day after the murder. He was issued a paycheck the day of the murder and cashed it the next day in Jacksonville. During the trial, a reporter asked Sheriff Beltwell about the defense's evidence. Beltwell said, quote, "Even if they don't believe Henry did this one, they know he did a lot of them and they'll want to see him put away for good," unquote. The jury found Lucas guilty. He was sentenced to death. Lucas was convicted of 9 other murders. For all the other convictions, he was given prison sentences. In April 1985, an article written by Hugh Ainsworth was published in the Dallas Times-Herald. Ainsworth provided evidence that Lucas couldn't have killed all the people he claimed to have murdered. He probably only killed 3 women, Viola Lucas, Kate Ridge, and Becky Powell. For murdering Powell and Ridge, Lucas was sentenced to 75 years of prison. The article alleged that Sheriff Beltwell was a major motivating factor in Lucas's false confessions. Beltwell supposedly told Lucas that if he stopped confessing, he would stop getting special treatment and be sent to death row. By the time the article was published, Lucas was on death row. In 1998, then-Governor George W. Bush made the surprising move of commuting Lucas's death sentence to life in prison. He said, quote, "While Henry Lee Lucas is guilty of committing a number of horrible crimes, serious concerns have been raised about his guilt in this case," unquote. Henry Lee Lucas died in June 2001 at age 64. In 2019, the body of the Jane Doe, known as Orange Socks, was identified. She was 23-year-old Deborah Jackson. Since Lucas's conviction was never overturned, he is still considered to be her killer. So when Catherine Morden was killed, some people were questioning Sheriff Beltwell's methods. Michael Morden worked until about 2 p.m. that day. He then went to the local mall and spent 90 minutes there. He then went to pick up Eric from the babysitter. The babysitter was surprised to see him, because Christine had not dropped off Eric that day. Michael used the babysitter's phone to call home. Sheriff Jim Beltwell answered the phone and told Michael he needed to come home. Michael rushed home. On the front doorstep, Beltwell informed Michael that his wife was dead. Beltwell brought him into the living room, where he and lead investigator, Sergeant Don Wood, questioned him. The dead body of his wife was still in the bedroom. The investigators found the note Michael wrote that morning and left on the mirror. Michael told the investigators that the family went out for dinner the night before and he left for work that morning at about 5:30. He acknowledged there had been strain in the marriage. However, Michael was adamant he had not killed his wife. There were no signs of a break-in or forced entry. Michael looked around the house and concluded that only his .45 caliber handgun and Christine's purse were missing. The police found 15 fingerprints at the crime scene that did not belong to the family. Some were found on an unlocked sliding glass door at the back of the house. Another fingerprint was found on the suitcase on her body. A fresh footprint was found in the backyard. A day after the murder, about 100 yards from the crime scene, near an abandoned construction site, Catherine's brother found a handkerchief. It had a few drops of blood on it. He gave it to the police. Then the police got the results of the autopsy. Based on the food partly digested in Christine's stomach, the medical examiner believed Christine was killed between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. That means Michael had time to murder Christine before going to work. But since Michael left for work at 5:30, it's possible that Christine was killed after he left for work. Michael cooperated with the investigation. He allowed the sheriff's department to search his vehicle. He also gave samples of his hair, saliva, and blood. He voluntarily took 2 polygraph exams, and he passed. The police talked to the media and acknowledged they had found a shoe print and some bloodstains a short distance from the crime scene. They concluded that the footprint had nothing to do with the murder. They also said that the bloodstains, by which they meant the bloody handkerchief, wasn't connected to the murder. It was found near an abandoned construction site, so they believed it was from a workplace accident. The police didn't name a suspect, but they said they were confident that people in the area were not in danger. Some people thought that Michael's behavior after Christine's murder was odd. For example, 2 days after the funeral, he used his weed whacker to cut down some marigolds that Christine had planted. Michael had not wanted the marigolds there. Michael also went back to sleeping in the same bed where his wife had been murdered. Several weeks after the murder, the medical examiner changed his ruling about the time of death. Initially, he believed that Christine ate her last meal at 11 p.m. But the police got the receipt from the restaurant where Christine and Michael ate the night before she died. They paid with a credit card at 9:21 p.m. So the medical examiner believed she was killed sometime between 9:30 p.m. and 1:30 a.m. By Michael's own admission, the only people in the home were him, Christine, and Eric. So on September 25th, 1986, 6 weeks after the murder, Michael was arrested for his wife's murder. A week later, he was released on bond. He remained Eric's parent and worked full-time at the grocery store. In February 1987, Michael Morin went to trial for the murder of his wife. The district attorney prosecuting the case, Ken Anderson, also prosecuted Henry Lee Lucas for the Orange Sox case. Anderson said that when Christine was murdered, Michael was angry that Christine didn't have sex with him on his birthday. He snapped and beat her to death. He wrote the note to make it look like she was alive, then he left for work. An expert said that semen was found on the bedsheet. It was the same blood type as Michael's. Anderson alleged that Michael beat his wife to death and then masturbated over her dead body. Anderson then showed the jury members photos of the dead body. Catherine's face had been beaten beyond recognition. The main evidence against Michael was the testimony of the medical examiner, Roberto Bayardo. Bayardo testified that Christine died between 9:30 p.m. and 1:30 a.m. when Michael was the only other adult in the house. Then Bayardo said something odd. He said that his estimation of the time of death was his opinion and not, quote, a scientific statement, unquote. The prosecution made an unusual choice regarding calling a witness from the sheriff's department. They had Sheriff Jim Bellwell testify, but not Don Wood, the lead investigator on the case. Bellwell's notes were entered into evidence, but since Wood wasn't going to testify, his notes and reports were not submitted. Bellwell only had 7 pages of handwritten reports. This was very little paperwork for a major homicide investigation. The defense pointed out that there was no physical evidence that Michael committed the murder. Yes, his semen was found on the bedsheets, but it was his marital bed. The semen was the only evidence that a husband and wife had sex recently. Michael told the investigators that he and Christine had sex a week before the murder. The defense pointed out that there was evidence that someone entered the home through the unlocked sliding glass door and killed Christine. The evidence was the footprint in the backyard and unidentified fingerprints on the door. The defense had 2 pathologists testify that the medical examiner's use of food digestion to estimate the time of death was flawed and inaccurate. Food digestion was not commonly used to determine the time of death. Several more accurate ways existed to determine the time of death, such as the settlement of blood and body temperature. There was another major problem with Roberto Bayardo's estimation of the time of death. Initially, he said that Christine was killed between 1 a.m. and 6 a.m. This could have given the jury reasonable doubt because Michael left for work at 5:30 a.m. However, Bayardo had based his original estimate on the belief that Christine ate her last meal at 11 p.m. When Bayardo learned that she last ate around 9 p.m., he changed his estimate to 9:30 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. Why was there such a big change in time? He learned that Christine had eaten 2 hours earlier than he originally believed. Yet, Bayardo changed the latest time she could have been killed from 6 a.m. to 1:30 a.m. a difference of 4.5 hours. Michael testified on his own behalf. He remained calm and emotionless on the stand. Meanwhile, Ken Anderson was emotional and screamed questions at Michael. Michael admitted that 4 years earlier, he had slapped Christine. He said it was the only time he had ever been violent with his wife. The trial lasted 6 days. The jury deliberated for less than 2 hours. They found Michael Morin guilty of murder and he was sentenced to life in prison. The district attorney, Ken Anderson, told reporters afterward, quote, "Life in prison is a lot better than he deserves," unquote. After the trial, there was a custody battle for Eric. Christine's family, who believed Michael had killed her, wanted custody, while Michael's parents, who thought he was innocent, wanted to raise the boy. Christine's younger sister, Mary Lee, got custody. A child psychiatrist suggested it'd be good for Eric to know his father. So a judge granted Michael 2 visits a year. Mary Lee brought Eric to each visit. When Eric was a teenager, he didn't like coming to the prison to visit his father. At age 15, he told his father he no longer wanted to come and he stopped visiting. Michael maintained that he was innocent. Michael's lawyers filed an appeal a year after he was convicted. The appeal claimed that the prosecution withheld evidence that could have cast doubt on Michael's guilt. According to law, the district attorney must disclose all evidence in the case to the defense, even if the evidence helps the defense. The appeal was denied, and Michael's conviction was upheld. Michael's lawyers appealed several more times, but they were always denied. In the early 1990s, while in prison, Michael read about DNA technology. He got a court order to have the bedsheet with a semen stain tested for DNA. At his trial, District Attorney Ken Anderson said that it was evidence that after Michael beat his wife to death, he masturbated over her body. A DNA test was conducted in 1991 and again in 1994. They were both inconclusive. In 2000, the sheets were tested for a third time. The stain was a mixture of Michael's semen and Christine's vaginal fluid. This just proved that Michael and Christine, a married couple, had sex shortly before the murder. In 2002, the Innocence Project took on Michael Morin's case. Michael had been in prison for about 15 years. The Innocence Project wanted to test all available evidence for DNA and they would pay for the testing. In 2001, Ken Anderson left the district attorney's office when he was named a district judge. In 2005, when the Innocence Project requested that the DNA be tested, Anderson's successor, John Bradley, fought the request. The attorneys working on Michael's case were surprised. The testing was going to cost the county nothing, and if Michael committed the murder, the district attorney should want the testing to prove they were correct. In 2006, a judge agreed to have all the evidence from the Morton's home tested for DNA. So that meant they couldn't test the DNA on the handkerchief that was found about 100 yards from the crime scene. Michael's lawyer argued that the fingerprints on the sliding glass door and the footprint in the backyard were evidence that someone had fled from the house. But the judge was not swayed by the arguments. The evidence from inside the home was tested, and the only DNA that was found belonged to Christine. In 2007, after 20 years in prison, Michael was out for parole. To get parole, Michael needed to take responsibility for the murder and show remorse. The district attorney's office opposed the parole because, as they correctly pointed out, Michael had never taken responsibility for the murder. At his parole hearing, Michael maintained he was innocent, so he was denied parole. Michael's lawyers with the Innocence Project continued to fight to have the handkerchief tested for DNA. In January 2010, a judge reversed the decision that barred the handkerchief from being tested. The judge ruled that the fingerprints and footprint showed evidence that someone had entered and fled the home. Plus, the DNA would prove or disprove if the handkerchief was evidence. In May 2011, the handkerchief was submitted for testing. The Innocence Project got the results a month later. Two sets of DNA were mixed in the bloodstains, Christine's and an unknown man's. Also, a strand of Christine's hair was found on the handkerchief. Michael's DNA was not on the handkerchief. The unknown male's DNA was submitted to CODIS. In August 2011, the Innocence Project was told that a match had been found. It belonged to Mark Allen Norwood. Norwood was born in March 1953. His father was an intelligence officer in the U.S. Air Force. The family moved often and lived in different places like France, California, and Guam. When Norwood was 17, his family moved to Austin. The same year, he dropped out of high school and joined the Air Force. Between 1980 and 1983, while in Nashville, Tennessee, Norwood was in and out of jail for crimes like arson and aggravated assault with a weapon. At some point in the mid-1980s, Norwood moved back to Austin. In May 1988, he was convicted of burglarizing two homes in Austin, and he served less than a year in jail. In 2007, Norwood was charged with felony possession of a controlled substance in Riverside, California. He got 3 years of probation. When he was convicted, the police collected a sample of his DNA. It was then uploaded to CODIS. In 2011, Norwood was living with his mother in Bastrop, Texas. He was working as a dishwasher. District Attorney John Bradley didn't think that the DNA match to Norwood proved Michael's innocence because the handkerchief was found 100 yards from the crime scene. So he was not going to consider requesting that Michael be released. The Innocence Project worked on an appeal to get Michael's conviction overturned. While writing the appeal, after years of litigation, the Innocence Project obtained the records and reports written by the lead investigator, Don Wood. In the notes, Wood recorded that several of the Morton's neighbors saw a man in a dark van parked in a vacant lot near the Morton's home in the days before the murder. After the murder, the neighbors called the police several times to tell them about the van, but no one followed up with them. Also in the notes, they found a transcript of a conversation between Sergeant Wood and Christine's mother, Rita Kirkpatrick, that happened about 2 weeks after the murder. Christine's family had taken to writing down everything that Christine and Michael's son, Eric, said. Eric told Rita he remembered his mother crying because there was a big monster with a big mustache in the house. Then the monster hit his mother and she stopped crying. The monster then threw a suitcase on his mother's head. Eric also remembered that the monster had a basket with him. In the basket was Wood. A lot of the details matched the crime scene. Christine was struck in the head with a piece of wood, like a log or a piece of lumber. Also, a suitcase and wicker basket were found on her body. Rita asked Eric if his father was there. Eric said it was just him and his mother at home. Rita said she was sure that Michael was innocent after talking to Eric. It was an 8-page transcript of the call, and that part of the conversation only took up 2 pages. Sergeant Wood didn't ask any follow-up questions about the monster for the rest of the conversation. Instead, he tried to convince Rita that when Eric said monster, he was referring to Michael wearing his scuba diving gear. All this information should have been disclosed to Michael's lawyers at his trial. He also suggests that something nefarious happened. Michael's original defense lawyers thought it was odd that Ken Anderson did not have Don Wood testify. Anderson didn't want Wood to testify because he didn't want the defense to get Wood's notes and reports because it would have damaged his case against Michael. But regardless, the evidence should have been disclosed because it cast doubt on Michael's guilt. But regardless, the evidence was legally supposed to be disclosed because the information could have cast doubt on Michael's guilt. Anderson always claimed that all pertinent evidence was disclosed to the defense. The Innocence Project tried to figure out if Mark Norwood could have committed the murder. If he was in jail or living in a different area, then it's possible that he didn't commit the murder. They learned that on the day of the murder, Norwood was in Austin and he wasn't in jail. An Innocence Project volunteer who helped investigate Norwood's background thought it was odd that Norwood had never been arrested for another murder. She decided to look online at cold cases in areas where Norwood had lived. She found something striking in Austin. A similar murder was committed 17 months after Christine was killed. In early 1988, 34-year-old Deborah Baker lived in Austin, and she was a mother of a son and a daughter. Deborah and her husband were separated at the time. She worked as a property manager. On the night of January 12th, Deborah's children were spending the night at their father's home. The next morning, January 13th, Deborah was found beaten to death in her bed. She had been struck 6 times in the head with a blunt object that wasn't found at the crime scene. Deborah's husband had been the prime suspect for 6 weeks, but then the sheriff's department decided he wasn't the killer. After that, the case went cold and no other progress was made on the case. There were several similarities between the murders of Christine Morden and Deborah Baker. They were both mothers in their early 30s. They were both white and had brown hair. Neither were raped. They were both struck multiple times in the head with a blunt object while in bed, and the murder weapons weren't found at either crime scene. Then some bedding was thrown over their faces. They were both killed on a Wednesday morning on the 13th of the month. Both times the killer entered and left through the back door. Also, at least one thing was stolen from the crime scene, but many valuables, like jewelry, were not taken. Michael's gun had been taken, and Deborah's VCR was stolen. The Innocence Project also learned that Mark Norwood lived 2 blocks from Deborah Baker's home at the time of the murder. He moved away from Austin 6 months later. Lawyers from the Innocence Project met with the Austin Police Department's cold case unit. The detectives agreed to open Deborah Baker's case to see if any evidence could be tested for DNA. They learned that 2 pubic hairs were found in Deborah Baker's bed. The hairs were tested for DNA and a profile was created. It was Norwood's DNA. It was obvious to Michael's lawyers, Mark Norwood committed both murders. In August 2011, there was a hearing about the handkerchief. The district attorney had a different theory about how Norwood's blood got on the handkerchief. They said Norwood could have dropped the handkerchief there another time. Then Catherine's brother brought it back to the crime scene, and that's when Christine's blood got on it. But then, 4 days later, District Attorney John Bradley agreed to release Michael on bond. He also said there would be an investigation into misconduct in the case. On October 3rd, 2011, Michael was released from prison. 8 days later, his conviction was overturned because the appeals court concluded he was innocent. Michael Morden has spent 25 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. A lot had changed in those 25 years. When Michael went to prison in 1987, the 3 biggest movies of the worldwide box office were Three Men and a Baby, Fatal Attraction, and Beverly Hills Cop 2. In 2011, the 3 top movies were Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, Transformers Dark of the Moon, and Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. The 3 best-selling albums of 1987 were Bad by Michael Jackson, The Dirty Dancing soundtrack, and Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses. In 2011, they were 21 by Adele, Christmas by Michael Bublé, and Plus by Ed Sheeran. Television shows that debuted in 1987 were married with children, Star Trek, The Next Generation, and Geraldo. 2011 saw the debuts of Suits, Game of Thrones, and American Horror Story. Popular books published in 1986 were Toni Morrison's Beloved, Tom Clancy's Patriot Games, and Tom Wolfe's The Bonfires of the Vanities. In 2011, Deborah Harkness's A Discovery of Witches, John Ronson's The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry, and A Monster Calls by Patrick Ness were all published. A month after Michael Morden was released from prison, there was a deposition. Ken Anderson, the district attorney who prosecuted the case, was called to testify. Anderson claimed he told Michael's lawyers about the conversation between Wood and Catherine's mother, where Eric talked about the monster committing the murder. Michael's lawyers were adamant Anderson never told them that information. If they had known about it, they would have used that information at trial, especially since Eric said that Michael was not there. It supported their theory that a home invader killed Christine. After the deposition, an inquiry into Anderson's actions was launched. On November 9, 2011, 57-year-old Mark Norwood was arrested for the murder of Christine Morden. A year later, he was charged with the murder of Deborah Baker. In 2012, John Bradley ran to be re-elected as district attorney. But many people were angry that he used taxpayer money to fight to keep Michael in prison. He lost the election by 10 points. In March 2013, Mark Norwood went to trial for the murder of Christine Morden. Norwood's lawyer pointed out that there was no physical evidence that placed Norwood in the Morden's house. 15 fingerprints that didn't belong to the family were found at the home. Those fingerprints also didn't belong to Norwood. The handkerchief with both his and Christine's DNA was found about 100 yards from the house. The handkerchief was found close to an abandoned construction site in a subdivision. At the time of the murder, Norwood was a carpet layer. The defense said he could drop the handkerchief another time. The defense argued that Christine's brother contaminated the handkerchief. Perhaps while at the crime scene, he got Christine's DNA on him and then transferred it to the handkerchief. Or he got Christine's DNA on it when he brought it back to the crime scene. Christine's brother, who found the handkerchief, testified that he didn't bring it close to the bedroom where the blood was. The prosecution also pointed out that by the time the handkerchief was found, all the blood in the house was dry, so there was no way her fresh blood drops could have gotten onto the handkerchief when her brother brought it into the home. A gun was stolen from the Morden's house on the morning of the murder. The police found the handgun that was stolen. In 2011, detectives from the Cold Case Unit went to Nashville to visit someone who was close friends with Norwood at the time of the murders, Louis Homer's Sonny Wan Jr. Wan talked to the police about his gun collection, and the detectives asked if he had a .45 caliber. He said he did. Norwood sold it to him many years earlier. He saw the gun, and he gave it to the police. Using the serial number, the police determined it was Michael Morden's gun. Wan said he didn't remember when Norwood sold him the gun, but he said it was the mid-1980s when they were doing a remodeling job for a probate judge named Guy Herman. Guy Herman testified at the trial. He had a bid from Wan's construction company, and he remembered hiring Wan to convert his garage into a bedroom because he recently had triplets. He said that this was in the summer of 1986. Christine was murdered in August 1986. The defense argued that the gun was not strong evidence that Norwood had been in the Morden house that morning. Notably, the gun wasn't found in Norwood's possession. Shouldn't the gun being in Wan's possession make him a stronger suspect? The only connection between Norwood and Michael's gun is Wan saying that Norwood sold it to him. The defense had Wan's ex-girlfriend and estranged daughter testify. They both said he was a habitual liar. Gwen's fingerprints were compared to the fingerprints found at the scene. They were not a match. The defense also noted that several neighbors saw a dark van parked near Christine's home days before the murder. Norwood did own a van at the time, but it was tan and white. The strongest evidence wasn't even from Christine's murder. Instead, the prosecution argued that the murders of Christine and Deborah Baker were so similar that the same man most likely committed them. The judge agreed, and even though Norwood had not been convicted of Deborah's murder, the district attorney was able to use the evidence from her case. The strongest evidence from Deborah's case was that Norwood's pubic hair were found in Deborah's bed. The defense argued that the pubic hairs got there before the murder. Deborah, who was separated from her husband, may have been intimate with Norwood. They also pointed out that Deborah had not been raped. There were 6 days of testimony. Then the jury deliberated for 3.5 hours. Norwood was found guilty of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison with a chance of parole after 15 years. In April 2013, former District Attorney Ken Anderson was arrested for contempt of court. In October 2013, as part of a plea deal, he pleaded guilty to contempt of court. For withholding evidence that resulted in Michael Morton spending 25 years in prison, Anderson lost his law license and he was sentenced to 10 days in jail. He was released after 5 days for good behavior. Ken Anderson is the only prosecutor in American history to have ever been jailed for misconduct leading to a wrongful conviction. In September 2016, Mark Norwood stood trial for the murder of Deborah Baker. The trial lasted 9 days. The jury deliberated for less than 2 hours. Once again, he was found guilty. He was given another life sentence with a chance of parole after 15 years. At the time of this recording, 7-year-old Mark Norwood is serving his sentence at the James V. Allred Unit in Wichita Falls, Texas. He'll be eligible for parole in 2031 when he'll be 77 years old. The police believe that Norwood could have committed other murders. He lived a bit of a transient lifestyle, so he may have committed murders throughout the United States. But he has not been charged with any other murders since he was charged with killing Christine Morton and Deborah Baker. Christine and Michael's son, Eric, was raised by his aunt, Mary Lee, who got married when he was 12. Eric considers Mary Lee his mother and her husband his stepfather. He later changed his surname to his stepfather's surname, Olson. Eric Olson attended Texas State University in Austin. Afterward, he went to work at his high school's ministry. He married a woman he met while volunteering at a church. Michael and Eric reconnected for the first time just before Thanksgiving 2011. It had been about a decade and a half since Eric visited Michael and told him he was breaking off contact with him. Their first meeting was awkward. Not long after Michael was released, he became a grandfather. Eventually, over many years, Michael and Eric rekindled their relationship. Michael is now a proud grandfather to 3 grandchildren. In 2013, Michael married Cynthia Chessman. Like his son, he met his wife at church. Michael received compensation of about $2 million, which is $80,000 for every year he was incarcerated. Michael used his 25 years in prison to better himself. He got a degree in psychology and a master's in literature. Today, Michael Morton works as a motivational speaker. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Like we said in the opening, if you have any cases to suggest for Into the Killing, Criminally Listed, or Paranormally Listed, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.